It's The Takeaway for June 4th. I'm Tanzina Vega. A ransomware attack in Baltimore puts a spotlight on vulnerable technical infrastructure across the country.
There are just so many ways to get into systems and so many known and unknown vulnerabilities out there that need to be addressed.
When you look at municipalities, a lot of them don't have the budget to allocate those resources to bolstering their securities.
What local governments can do to protect themselves and why that's going to be difficult. Also on the show, the Canadian government says that centuries of policies that led to increased violence against Indigenous women and girls amounts to genocide.
It's not a fast-moving mass killing, but it is a slow death. It is a death by a million paper cuts.
And on the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, we talk about its legacy. But we start in Baltimore. No access to government emails, no online payments to city departments, and thousands of pending home sales. Those are just some of the problems that have plagued the city of Baltimore since it was hit with a ransomware attack almost a month ago. Hackers left a message saying they would give back control of the city servers for 13 bitcoins, but Baltimore hasn't paid the ransom. And while the city is still in the process of restoring its digital infrastructure, this is not the first time that cyber criminals have paralyzed a major U.S. city. Atlanta was the victim of a massive ransomware attack last year, and it was just one of at least 169 known attacks on state and local governments since 2013. And these attacks are highlighting the vulnerabilities of U.S. cities, and some companies are wondering how to keep their lights on while federal and state authorities are working to reduce the chances of more hacks in the future. With me now are Emily Sullivan, a City Hall reporter for WYPR in Baltimore, and Lee W. McKnight, associate professor in the iSchool, the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
So, Emily, how did Baltimore get hacked?
I think creating a metaphor about how this all happened is important since it's such an abstract idea. Imagine if, in the dead of night, a masked thief snuck into your local government building and loaded up every single document there, like pending permits, pending house closings, legislative drafts, and put it all in a truck and drove away. Now imagine that they put those documents in a warehouse that only they had the key to and demanded ransom money in order to unlock it. That's what's virtually happened in Baltimore nearly a month ago. The specific malware that anonymous hackers used to do this is called Robinhood. It encrypts all the data I just talked about and makes it inaccessible without a digital key. And experts say that it is virtually impossible to access that data without that key. Even the NSA doesn't have the ability to somehow replicate it. As you said, the hackers who are anonymous have demanded Bitcoin in exchange, and our mayor, Jack Young, has said multiple times the city will not pay this ransom. Baltimore was using outdated hardware and software, which cybersecurity experts say unfortunately makes systems very vulnerable. So while we don't have confirmation of how exactly the malware entered the system, that's the thing that experts are pointing to and saying is likely the cause.
Emily, we mentioned at the top some examples of things that had happened. For example, no access to government emails, etc. What are some other examples of what the impact of this hack was?
As you mentioned, basically the contents of every computer associated with Baltimore City are inaccessible. So city council members can't access documents of, you know, drafts or bills on their computers. Emails were down for city workers. The city has been able to restore some service, and they're prioritizing departments like police and fire. Online payments for things like water and parking tickets can't be made. So the city is suspending late fees on these bills. And the city has also been unable to pay some of its vendors. Most notably, I think, all real estate sales were totally stalled in the city because the lien system is inaccessible. The government was able to come up with what they call a manual workaround, but overall, the officials have said the revenue impact to the city is around $18 million. That's $10 million in response costs and another $8 million of what they call potentially lost or delayed revenue, like, you know, the parking tickets I was talking about.
Lee, I'm wondering, what was it about Baltimore's infrastructure that actually allowed this to happen? I mean, were they just unprepared, or was the hack even more sophisticated than the system could handle?
I'm afraid it was exactly what you said at the beginning, that they had this vulnerability that was Emily mentioned was known for several years, and there'd been an advisory sent out by Microsoft advising everybody to patch it and close it up 2 years ago. And obviously, that was not done in Baltimore. So I'm afraid it's a matter of manpower and following through on what they were advised to do by their vendors. Now, there, of course, there's many, many of these patching updates and notices going out about vulnerabilities in software. But in this case, it has to, well, somebody should be embarrassed because they were warned about this and it wasn't taken care of even after they had a somewhat smaller scale incident, I believe, about a year ago.
So, Lee, I'm curious. We mentioned also at the top that this is the Baltimore hack was just one of at least 169 known attacks on state and local governments since 2013. What does that tell us about our infrastructure, just our technical infrastructure across the country?
Well, I was quoted in USA Today a couple weeks ago talking about local governments as and city governments as soft targets, which meaning basically, you know, corporations got those notices from Microsoft too, and they have the staff and the manpower and the money to go ahead and patch their systems so they wouldn't be vulnerable to this. Unfortunately, well, as you say, Baltimore doesn't have a lot of money, and the staff is stretched and under strain and has older systems. So in general, local governments, city governments are sort of easy, and that's why you're hearing more and more about these attacks is on the professional corporate side or U.S. federal government side. These kind of things probably were closed up some time ago for this particular vulnerability. And not to say that there aren't others out there. So in general, there is a big problem for city, state, local government, small business, because there are just so many ways to get into systems and so many known and unknown vulnerabilities out there that need to be addressed.
Now, I'm wondering, Lee or Emily, if either one of you could respond, what is it that makes city and state or local governments like Baltimore so attractive for hackers? Is it just because it's simple, as you said, Lee, because they're vulnerable? Or is there something else that makes these attractive targets?
Something I think is interesting is just looking at the history of cyber attacks, right? For a while, hospitals were actually big targets. And if you think about it, it makes sense, at least from the viewpoint of hackers. Hospitals have data that's vital to its operations, and people could die if patient charts are lost, right? But after some hospitals were targeted, hospitals throughout the country responded really fast. They bolstered IT systems. They spent a lot of money on cybersecurity literacy training. When you look at municipalities, a lot of them don't have the budget to allocate those resources to bolstering their securities. I think, you know, you could say that hospitals learned from attacks on other hospitals, while municipalities still really view this as an abstract threat. At least that was the case here in Baltimore.
You know, we mentioned, we had a story on The Takeaway a couple weeks ago about a vulnerability in WhatsApp. And one of the things that that emerged in that conversation was sort of the onus that is on the end user to, you know, update their software and put in these patches to make sure that they're not vulnerable to security hacks. Lee, is it reasonable to expect cities like Baltimore to totally be on top of cybersecurity if it's something like a Microsoft patch, or as you mentioned? I mean, isn't that something that could fall through the cracks?
Absolutely, and it will continue to happen. So there is a need for sort of a new approach and more help and assistance. So that's some of what we're involved with and working with some of the federal government agencies and with the private sector and nonprofit. So there's a nonprofit organization out of Silicon Valley called Adaptable Security that we're working with. Also, they're working closely with NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the Department of Commerce to provide volunteers to help local governments and do, you know, that information security awareness that Emily mentioned. That's so vital because essentially it's not really the responsibility of any one person nowadays for information security. Everybody has to be more aware. Everybody needs a little more training and attentiveness to these issues. And there's new resources that we should pull in, which are beyond the scope of what any local city or government could reasonably expect to have. Those same retired professionals before they retired were pretty expensive. So now if there's a way to bring together help for local governments that doesn't break their budget, that does help raise everybody's training level so that they can do a better job in preventing some of these, that's the part of the way forward.
Also, you know, I'm wondering, we don't know who exactly was behind these attacks, but are there suspects here in terms of, you know, are these foreign adversaries? Are these national adversaries that are interested in hacking into systems? Or have we just not seen a pattern yet in who's behind these attacks, particularly when it comes to state and local governments?
The FBI and Secret Service are both aiding Baltimore in investigating the attacks right now. And because of that, the city is being very tight-lipped about giving any information out. So I don't have a lot of information about who they're suspecting, but the cybersecurity expert I've talked to, and perhaps Liam can chime in here, all suggest it's a foreign adversary. That's what was the case in Atlanta. It's what's been, from what I understand, traditionally the case in municipalities, but we don't have confirmation here.
Also, we know that Baltimore decided not to pay the ransom behind this attack. Was that an effective strategy?
Well, from all the cybersecurity experts I've spoken to, which at this point in the duration of the attack has been a lot, the one thing people keep saying is that the reason why these attacks keep happening is because ransoms keep getting paid. So the common philosophical viewpoint from the cybersecurity community is that no one should ever pay the ransom, because if no one ever did, the attacks would stop. That's been the attitude of Baltimore leaders. One thing that our mayor, Jack Young, keeps saying is he wished that someone with the resources of these hackers could instead use their powers for good. For now, we won't be paying.
And Lee, going forward, are there cities or even private companies in particular, we mentioned hospitals, that could serve as a model for how to move forward in a secure way?
Well, there's a sort of a broader approach needed, like with public-private partnerships, and that's part of what we're working on. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, several federal agencies have been working with smart cities and communities around the world. There's something called the Cybersecurity Privacy Advisory Committee that I have a group called an Action Cluster with, working with the city of Syracuse, that brings together academics, IBM, Microsoft, Dell, VMware, other vendors to assist cities and municipalities in improving their practices and upgrading their systems over time. So there's a broader approach needed. And beyond that, there's a specific secure cloud architecture model for not just for one company or one city government, but for a whole region. That is what I'm working on and promoting with our cybersecurity, privacy, and rights-inclusive architecture for a cloud approach. So essentially, if Baltimore got hacked, if everything was backed up in the cloud, would it really matter? And the answer is no, because you lost a day's data, not, you know, getting the whole city shut down. So that if you modernize your approach and work collaboratively and use cloud for backup, then essentially the cities become less vulnerable. Going back to what was said, I'm afraid, of course, cities shouldn't pay the ransom, but exactly because there's probably hundreds more I know police departments that have been hacked that have paid the ransom just to get their systems back. So Baltimore's done the right thing by not paying, but they're going to pay the price. They're going to be down for months. It's going to cost much more than $10 million to restore, because they're going to need to buy a new system. Some of that data will never get recovered, or most of it will never get recovered. It's going to be just looking at Atlanta's case and how much of a headache and what the cost was over time. So we need a new approach, a different approach that's been taken in the past, or this is guaranteed to continue to happen and guaranteed to continue to get worse over time.
Lee McKnight is an associate professor in the iSchool, the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. And Emily Sullivan is a City Hall reporter for WYPR in Baltimore. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
On Monday, a report investigating the widespread murder and disappearances of Indigenous women and girls in Canada was released, and it lays the blame at Canada's feet.
This is genocide.
That was Marion Buller, the Chief Commissioner of Canada's National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, speaking Monday. But while Buller and the report were deliberate in their use of the word genocide, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau avoided the term when speaking yesterday.
Many institutions will find this day, this report, these truths difficult, challenging, and uncomfortable. This is an uncomfortable day for Canada.
The findings in the report were reached after the inquiry heard testimony from hundreds of family members of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Lorelei Williams was one of the women who testified.
I am a family member of a missing woman and a murdered woman.
Lorelei is the women's coordinator at the Vancouver Aboriginal Community Policing Center, and she works with families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
My auntie Belinda Williams has been missing since 1978. My cousin Tanya Holick went missing in 1996.
Belinda was never found, but Tanya's DNA was later discovered on serial killer Robert Picton's farm. Lorelei told The Takeaway she struggled to speak publicly about her family's traumatic story.
It was so hard for me. I have a great support system. Even with all that, I was finding it hard to even get out of bed the day that I had to testify. I just laid in my bed and I just started crying, and my crying wouldn't stop. When I messaged my supports, they actually came and got me, and that was the only way I was able to get out of bed.
The new report makes a number of recommendations to the Canadian government, but Lorelei says the question, as always, is whether the state will implement those suggestions to create real change.
If the recommendations are implemented as soon as possible, then yeah, maybe there could be some justice for my family. I mean, the issue of missing and murdered women is still happening. So in order to feel that justice, I feel like no more women. And there is no justice for my missing aunt, right? She's still gone. She's missing.
Joining us now to discuss the new report from Canada's National Inquiry is Veldon Coburn, faculty member at the School of Indigenous and Canadian Studies at Carleton University in Ottawa. Veldon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a sense of some of the major points in the report.
Well, a lot of it talks about justice and human rights, and it's a rights-based approach. It opens up quite clearly on that point, is that Indigenous women and girls, as structured further down, probably at the bottom of the lowest social strata, have, even though had formalized rights in, say, the Constitution and other sort of legislative instruments, the Canadian state and Canadian society as a whole has evaded and eluded what is understood as substantive equality.
Veldon, we heard a little from Lorelei Williams a few moments ago, who's an Indigenous Canadian woman whose aunt is missing and whose cousin was murdered. Let's take a listen to what she told us about finding justice for her family.
When my auntie Dixie tried to report Tanya missing, she was faced with a racist, judgmental civilian clerk who was saying things like, she's probably just in Mexico partying, she's just a drug addict, nobody cares about her. She actually called my aunt a bad mom.
How common is that experience, Veldon?
Sadly, the discrimination that Indigenous people face from the moment of contact with the justice system, this is quite a common occurrence. The discriminatory approach, the negative stereotypes that are embedded within these institutions get played out by the personalities of characters and actors of the state.
Veldon, the use of the word genocide, can you give us a sense of what the significance of that word is, particularly in Canadian history?
So settler colonialism began 425 years ago or so. And from almost the get-go, it has been the elimination or the goal of settler states back when it was the British Crown and the French Crown here settling in Canada, is the elimination of Indigenous peoples. And that was fairly explicit within policy, even into the 20th century, by bureaucrats at the highest ranking of Indigenous affairs here in Canada, back when it was Indian affairs, was quite stated in Canada's parliament that we want to get rid of Indigenous people. That is our goal. So explicitly stating this, but carrying it out in really damaging and detrimental policies that only result in death and large-scale death. But it's not mass rounding up that one would understand or what is depicted in popular representations or what is conjured when we think of genocide. But it's a very slow death of Indigenous nations and peoples in Canada. Policies where infant mortality rates that are unacceptably high any place in the world, but here in Canada it's fairly normalized. And it's carried out today. And the idea of genocide right now is something that Indigenous people have been saying, is that you're actually killing us as a people. So the sum total, as this inquiry had said, of social practices, of policies, amounts to genocide. It's not a fast-moving mass killing, but it is a slow death. it is a death by a million paper cuts, as Chief Commissioner Marion Bullard stated yesterday at the media reporting.
Veldin, we heard Prime Minister Justin Trudeau earlier calling the findings of the report uncomfortable and not choosing to use the word genocide. Why do you think the Prime Minister was reluctant to use the word genocide?
Oh, you know, it's been hundreds of years culminating to this point. Perhaps the report being dropped into his hands at that moment. But again, the word and early editions had been leaked to the media back on Friday. So they had the whole weekend to digest the fact that this was going to call out the states and Canadian society on genocide. But being uncomfortable about it, I don't think Justin Trudeau personally has a great deal in carrying out and implementing genocide himself. So I'm not too sure what his personal disposition is. But I mean, he holds a great deal of power over the lives of Indigenous peoples in ways that would be unacceptable to any person in a liberal democracy. So in some ways, he's head of the government that has in the past carried it out. And his father was actually prime minister for over 15 years in Canada. So looking back, he may have to indict his own father for fairly horrific practices that have culminated in genocide of Indigenous people. But it is an uncomfortable truth for other people to realize, but that pales in comparison to the uncomfortable truth of those who are living it out, the victims of it.
We understand that there have been prior reports outlining similar conclusions. Is there anything new here?
Well, the newest thing is the topic that we've just been discussing is the fact that, and it took Indigenous women in a commission with a chief commissioner and several commissioners as well, including one male commissioner, to come out and say that this was genocide. And while it does repeat a great deal of past inquiries and commissions, and Indigenous people have endured those for the last 25 years, going back to the 1990s and the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, this may reiterate and restate a lot of the same findings, but the biggest matter here and aspect is the conclusion, and I can draw no other conclusion myself than it is genocide.
Veldin Coburn is a faculty member at the School of Indigenous and Canadian Studies at Carleton University. Veldin, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And on Wednesday and Thursday of this week, The Takeaway will be broadcasting from KUER in Salt Lake City, Utah, where we'll be doing some work on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in that region and in the U.S. as a whole. Thirty years ago today, China's communist government began a violent crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Military tanks rolled through the protesters' camps, shooting and killing hundreds who had gathered there. In the 30 years since the massacre, China has tried to censor any mention of the events at Tiananmen Square. In advance of today's anniversary, Chinese officials created a so-called Great Firewall of China, which blocks all websites that mention Tiananmen, the massacre, or the date, June 4th, 1989. Joining us today from Washington, D.C. to talk about the legacy of Tiananmen is Renee Xia, the director of the Chinese Human Rights Defenders Network. Renee, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Also with us is Arthur Kent, and he covered the Tiananmen protest as an independent TV journalist. He's now a filmmaker and recently restored his 30-year-old footage to make a short film about Tiananmen called Black Night in June. Arthur, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Arthur, there had been about 2.5 months of protests at Tiananmen before the martial law declaration. What was happening and how did it get to that point?
Well, there was almost a carnival atmosphere attached to the demonstrations, great exuberance, these massive crowds, not just in Beijing, but in cities across China. I visited Xi'an, the ancient capital, and the students there from Northwest University had as well built an encampment in the center of the city, and it began marking, revering the passing of a reform-minded member of the Chinese Communist leadership, and then it picked up steam as the students, with great optimism and hope for democratic reform, and most of all for reform of corruption which the Chinese people perceived in the leadership, corruption, which continues to this day, sadly. But it mounted force, and sadly, on the 20th of May, the hardliners within Xiaoping's communist leadership took sway, and a gentleman named Li Peng declared martial law on the 20th of May. Thereafter, there was an increase in tension and a feeling that there would be a reckoning, although no indication that such a bloody act as the assault of June 3rd and 4th was coming.
Renee, what can you tell us about the political mood of China in 1989? I mean, understanding that you were in school in the United States at the time.
Yeah, the country had opened up since the late 70s, after Mao died, after the disastrous Cultural Revolution. So for 10 years, it was this opening up, and it's called the Thought Liberation Movement. So lots of censorship blocks were left. People were able to read books and newspapers and films from abroad. And the market was starting to experiment, opening, the economy started to grow. People had this sense of liberation, particularly from the ideological point of view. A lot of the mistakes Mao made were discussed openly. So I think it was natural for the students, Tiananmen Square, where even though they started with a calling for end corruption, but they quickly moved on to call for democratization and freedom of the press. There was, as author described, there was this a sense that China is going to go somewhere, and their efforts, their demonstration will draw attention to help the party. That's the key. They think they are helping the party to clean itself up and move forward.
Renee, we mentioned at the top of the show that Chinese officials have essentially blocked information for people in China to get any information about what happened at Tiananmen, the massacre, the date. Are you surprised by that?
I'm not surprised, because they have blood on their hands, and they feel their legitimacy will take a big hit if the truth comes out that hundreds, if not more, are being killed and many more injured, and thousands were put in jail, some executed. So all this page of history needs to be opened up, investigated. There need to be accountability, but the accountability, the trials will go all the way to the top, and they're not ready to abandon their rule of the country. So they needed, from their point of view, to cover up the truth.
Arthur, I'm thinking about the image of Tiananmen that is perhaps most seared in many of our minds, those of us who remember actually it playing out. I remember watching this on television and seeing the man who essentially goes out into the street and really waits for a tank to attack, and the tank does not. Can you describe that moment for our listeners and what was happening at that time?
Well, it was extraordinary, you know, and there were photographers, including Jeff Widener of AP, who took the famous tank man shot. His was the first shot that got out of Beijing, so it's become known as the definitive one. But there were other photographers and cameramen in the Beijing hotel. So the morning after the massacre, it was actually the afternoon, I think. And I remember my friend, Tony Wasserman of NBC News, from Johannesburg, South Africa, was manning his camera position on the 12th floor balcony of the Beijing Hotel, and there was just about to be a shift change. And another friend, Gary Fairman, a mad Australian cameraman, was coming to take Tony's place. And there had been tanks and assemblies of troops in the square from daylight after the worst of the carnage had taken place, and everybody had kept their lenses trained on that situation, and nothing seemed to be changing at that moment. The very moment that Tony unclipped his camera from his tripod, and Gary was about to put his camera in its place, Tony said, "Wait, mate. Hold on." And he saw this lone citizen walk with a briefcase in one hand, his coat slung over the other, out of nowhere, and approach a column of tanks that was proceeding eastward out of the square. And thankfully, as we know, the tank stopped. I think could it be a credit to the tank commander to have stopped? Could it be because the martial law authorities, the Communist Party, as well understood, oh, it's daylight, there's too many witnesses, we can't run this guy over. Eventually his friends, after he climbed up on the tank and tried to engage the crew, convinced him to withdraw.
It was a stunning moment. Arthur Kent is a filmmaker and broadcast journalist who covered Tiananmen Square protests and recently released a short documentary called Black Night in June. You can find that at thetakeaway.org. Arthur, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Renee Xia is the director of the Chinese Human Rights Defenders Network. Renee, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.